And my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Change it.
Turn and face the strain.
Change it.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Hello everyone, welcome to Everton Business Matters. We're series 4, episode 10. That, for those people who live on Mars or have ever lived on Mars, was David Bowie with Changes, which is apparently one of the favourite songs all time of one of my two co-conspirators, Paul the Esk. Paul, tell us why you're a Bowie man.
I'm not sure I really want to go into why, but he joins a very, very select group of singers, artists, whatever, that I will ever listen to.
Okay.
What and, was that? What was their name, Paul?
I can't remember, John. Hi, Kate.
Right. Well, there you go. A little bit of personal history there, but we are here today with Everton Business Matters. John, you just heard in the background. John, you all right?
I'm good, my friend. Yes, yep. Hope you are too.
Yep. Yes, fine. And today we have come together to discuss largely football governance, but we're going to take football governance in the context of this proposed dreadful idea of the European Super League, sanctions that may or may not flow from it, and actions that may or may not flow from it in terms of the reorganization, the restructuring, and the control, the governance, if you will, of the beautiful game. But it was triggered, the idea to come together today, talk about this, was triggered by Don Carlo getting involved in his press conference in between whichever game was the last one and whichever game is the next one, where he said that actually any notion of Everton being in breach of profit and sustainability is a bit of a joke, really, because surely there are much bigger issues at stake, such as punishment for the Big Six, and kind of quite cleverly deflected any attention from our financial predicaments and where we are with profit and loss onto the issue of the Big Six. What did you make of those comments, John? It was strange for Carlo to get involved at that level of, you know, corporate type news. What did you think of his comments?
I suppose if it was a binary, I'd come down as finding it quite amusing and not a bad thing to say. I think as we go into the podcast, Roger, and we're going to be talking about governance, aren't we? And perhaps one suspects we won't all agree on what we think the right way forward is. But lest we forget, notwithstanding the treacherous six, should still be called that, all these football clubs and all these managers and all these players and indeed all these fans, we all have vested interests. And I think he was laying down, you know, some politics, if you will. I suspect it's coordinated with perhaps what's going on behind the scenes. And, you know, looking after Everton if he can.
Yeah. I thought it was a little bit disingenuous, to be honest with you, Paul. You know, this is a guy who's managed PSG and, you know, managed Milan and managed Chelsea, managed big clubs for whom, you know, Real Madrid, of course. And I know PSG weren't part of the breakaway, but, you know, he's managed at the very, very top table. And if he'd been the manager of a club going towards the European Super League and the European Super League had been a thing happening, I don't think he'd have protested too much. So I thought it was a little bit naive, Paul. What did you make of it?
I thought he was playing, almost as John said there, I thought he was playing a role for the organisation that pays his salary, which is probably consistent with what he's done throughout his career.
Yeah,
I think he was saying, not too subtly, first of all, the punishment agenda needs to be continued, and it, you know, we need to come to a decision on what the punishment should be, and the punishment should be appropriate to the crime. And also, if by any chance Everton happened to not comply with profit and sustainability, don't come knocking on our door looking to deliver a punishment if you haven't done the same for the six previously. Equally importantly, the scale of the misdemeanor, if it is such for us, is significantly less than that of the six. So where do we start? Do we start with making sure there's an appropriate punishment for the six? Or do we start with, if we happen to break these regulations and you haven't punished the six, well, there's not an awful lot you can do to us, is there?
Isn't the punishment done now? Haven't they given them some 5% fine and a couple of million quid? Don't UEFA and the other authorities...
Roger, we have to separate what UEFA have done and what the Premier League are going to do, if indeed they're going to do anything. So the six are being punished, in inverted commas, by both bodies. So whatever's happened at UEFA doesn't necessarily relate to what's going to happen within the Premier League. So UEFA, as a regulator, has put out its punishment, which is, you know, 15 million euros plus 5% spread between the participants and 5% of this year's European revenues. So far, the Premier League have removed senior people from five committees.
Can I just add to that, Paul? I mean, you could just flip back to Carlo briefly, and then I'll comment on that, because I think that's where we're going to get into the nub of this. I think I'm not convinced he's being disingenuous, Roger, expressing a view on the position he and his employer finds themselves in. I do agree. He may very well, if he was, you know, managing Milan or PSG or, well, not PSG because they're one of the good guys, but one of the other, say Juve, that he may have a different view. But that doesn't necessarily make him disingenuous, I don't think. As far as what you're talking about there, Paul, and I think it's important, I don't know whether there's some clever work going on here between UEFA and the national leagues, but clearly UEFA don't appear to think that a sporting punishment is appropriate. They're already getting warned off, you know, punishing the last three standings, so to speak. So focus may come on the national leagues, and in our case, the Premier League. And I think Masters, you know, the chief exec of the Premier League, who fundamentally is a marketing guy, isn't he? You know, I think he said, and I don't know whether it was just before whatever Carlo said, or but it was certainly on or around. And he said something akin to, you know, we need to put the Super League behind us, talk to the six, and decide what to do going forward. And we're doing that. I mean, if that's not a kick the can down the road and we're on our bended knees saying to the six, please, sir, may I punish you in a way that looks like I've punished you, blah, blah, he's at best a bloody damn wet guy and at worst complicit in allowing these clubs to get away with it. And I think our football club is hopefully behind the scenes and a little glimmer in the public eye is saying, these people need to be punished. And at the end of the day, the punishment needs to be a sporting punishment. And that means, I guess, points deductions.
But that's not going to happen, is it? Let's be honest. That is absolutely not going to happen, because the six will just get the biggest and best lawyers in the land. And the only punishment that they're going to accept and that is will go through will be some sort of diluted financial punishment from the Premier League.
You say that, Roger, and maybe and not you personally, but maybe that's part of the problem, you know, because you just said they're not going to accept that. And I don't mean you, I suspect you mean it in a hierarchical sense, but there comes a moment, you know, a tipping point, whatever you want to call it, when actually people have to say, you know what, we're going to do the right thing. And the right thing is not to allow these six with financial strength to say, you're not going to punish us for us trying to destroy football in this country. And if that means the Premier League and the Football Association have to spend every goddamn penny they've got in the courts because these six think they're bigger than the game, then you know what? I think they'd have the whole of the fan bases behind them. I think fan pressure would very quickly get at least one. And then once it becomes one, it becomes two, three, four, five, six. Those clubs that say, you've been naughty, you need to take your punishment. And you seeking to avoid what a huge volume of informed, one rather hope, stakeholders in this country think is the right answer, which is a sporting punishment. if you want to fight that with your financial strength, we'll call it, then that is actually just part of the problem. And the next time you apply to be a member of the Premier League, maybe you'll find yourself being declined. I mean, it's all about who blinks first and whether you've got the testicular fortitude to actually stand up to the playground bully or not. And I think you're right. In some contexts, Masters doesn't sound like a guy who's standing square up against these guys. We rather hope that Everton and Baxendale, who might be, for whatever our strengths and weaknesses are, one of the few leaders in that stakeholder group, hopefully is holding the line. But the real issue, of course, Roger, is not what the six do. It's what the 14 do. And I'm perhaps with you. I have little confidence that as a group, they've got the testicular for it.
There's so much to unpack from all of that.
There is, mate. Yeah.
First of all, UEFA interfering in the affairs of a domestic league. So
absolutely. Their comment was very.
UEFA came out.
Yeah.
UEFA came out and said that on behalf of the clubs, they were asking that the leagues that were implicated in this to look at what the clubs had done in terms of immediately removing themselves from the Super League and to use that as a means of mitigation. So UEFA were saying, because these nine clubs, six of whom are the English clubs, were the first to sort of leave the Super League, that they shouldn't be punished because that's, you know, that they acted appropriately once it had come out in the open, which is a complete nonsense and way beyond UEFA's remit. They shouldn't be getting involved. And they don't have the authority to get involved in national leagues. So that's the first point. The second point, I think, is the problem that Richard Masters has is that he's trying to punish somebody in his position would be trying to punish 30% of his shareholders.
Absolutely,
and in business, that just hardly ever happens. I can't think of an instance where it can happen.
Well, can I just interject? I don't want to spoil what I think is going to be a really good piece, Paul. But if you carry in the context of, it won't be he, will it? It'll be the league, and the league is the shareholders, and the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And it might be unusual for a business to penalise, for want of a phrase, a third of its shareholding, but not if it's because the other two thirds want the third to be punished.
I mean,
do the other two thirds want that?
I think that's where the focus needs to be, isn't it, Roger? I think you're right, mate. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just not convinced, because I think there is naivety and double standards here, because I'm sure that Leicester, Everton, Palace, West Ham, Leeds United, Aston Villa would have loved to have been invited into that European Super League. And they would love to be in a world where revenues were guaranteed and they were always competing at the top table. So, you know, I'm just not entirely sure that the values of the six are utterly despicable and that the 14 are so, pristine and lily white in their attitudes.
That's a bit too binary, though, isn't it, Roger? Because I was about to disagree with you until you did the pristine and lily white bit on the other side.
I would there's a couple of other points I want to make, but I would be arguing on that point that it's not so much what they did, it's the fact that they acted in bad faith.
Absolutely, that's where I was going. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's rule B15, and you know, that's a binary rule. You either act in good faith or you act in bad faith, and it's clearly, you can clearly demonstrate that they've acted in bad faith. So whether we wanted to be part of whatever it was that they wanted to create is almost a moot point, because we weren't part of it, so we weren't able to act in bad faith. But the fact that we weren't able to act in bad faith and others did means that they should be punished. I think the negotiating point for those of the 14 that want to go hardball on this must be, if we don't self-regulate ourselves properly, and this is the primary instance of doing so, then leave ourselves open to a regulation from outside of football. And that's, I think that's the point that they must argue, that we need to punish U6 as severely as we can, and we need to be seen to be doing things properly, because if we don't, we're going to end up not having the powers of regulation ourselves, and we're going to have an appointed regulator. Now, I happen to think that an appointed regulator is a good thing for football. So in a sense, if there isn't an appropriate punishment, it strengthens my case and strengthens the case of other people that say, you can't regulate yourselves, therefore we're going to appoint an independent regulator to do the job that you've proved unable to do for yourselves.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack and there's a lot to discuss here, but let me just try and distill this down to what you want to happen. Therefore, an appropriate sporting punishment as you see it for the six, is it a 20-point deduction for each of them? Are they all treated in exactly the same way, or do Chelsea get less because they ducked out first? What do you actually think is right and proper, both of you, please? Just quickly, the sanction that you would have if it was down to you, Paul, or you, John, what would you do to them six?
I think there's no mitigation in this, so it doesn't matter whether who ducked out first. You're not punishing them for what they did once the Super League was discovered, which is UEFA's stance. You're punishing them for what they did prior,
right,
to the publication of the public of the Super League. And you know, I've said consistently from the moment it happened, the only appropriate punishment is relegation. I know it's not going to happen, but
But if it's not going to happen, what's realistic then?
I don't know if we talked about this last time, Paul, because I think many people would like your appropriate view. Actually, I wouldn't go that far because, again, vested interest. I would do an approach that could result in relegation, Roger,
yeah.
Which fundamentally is a points deduction, a significant points deduction, maybe 20 points or something, maybe more, 25, certainly more points deducted than ever been deducted before in the pyramid in this country. And I can't remember, but I think 15 or 17 or whatever has been done in the past. So
needs to be more. Pompey have the record, don't they?
Do they? Yeah. Quite possibly serial offenders at one stage, weren't they? And do that, and then the fun becomes, do you do that retrospectively at the end of this season or the start of next season? And I think to bring the excitement back to the game, per se, it may be quite amusing if those six start in the bottom six positions in the Premier League next year with minus 25 points, and it's quite possible at least one of them, perhaps Arsenal, maybe, who knows, would actually go down if that happened. And let's see how good some of those managers are and some of those players are when they're under the pressure for what would be the first couple of months of the season, as a minimum, hanging around in the lower reaches. And that, of course, then could and perhaps should result in, at the end of next season, very few, if any, of those getting into Europe through the league.
Okay.
That's a bit like tying Usain Bolt's laces together. Because he's been taking drugs. Not that he has been taking drugs, I hesitate to
I don't think that analogy works, Paul.
If he was a drug taker, you remove him from the competition. So,
that's why it's a matter of opinion, isn't it? I think, you know, to challenge you, when you say relegation, do you mean to the Championship or do you mean out of the whole of the pyramid?
I mean to the Championship, because there are clear economic benefits for the Premier League and for the Championship in doing so. It would actually be beneficial to the pyramid itself.
Potentially, yeah.
Okay, right, that's sanctions. That's the short term. But the bigger picture is what we do with governance football going forward, the self-regulation versus the independent governance. And Paul, you've written a couple of pieces, and I know you've spoken quite widely in the footballing and political community about this. So just tell us what you see as the right way for football to govern itself, or football to be governed post the European Super League.
I think, first of all, you have to say the way football's structured at the moment, the people that promote and organise competitions, tournaments, so UEFA, the Premier League, even the English Football League and all of the other leagues around Europe, act both as the promoter and the organizer of competitions, but they also act as the regulator. And I think that you can't do that without there being a conflict of interest at some point along the way. And we're obviously at that point now, where both the Premier League and UEFA feel as the organisers and promoters of competitions, they have a conflict of interest, because if the punishment is too strong, or if the punishment is appropriate but seems to be too strong, does it damage everybody else? Does it damage the competition? And so they'll always err on caution in those circumstances. So my view is very much as, you know, for example, what happens in most democracies. You separate the executive in this case being the Premier League or being UEFA, from the legislature. Sorry, that didn't come out properly.
Is that another one of those words you can't
it
say?
It is, yeah. I think I'm going to see a speech therapist or somebody. Anyway, the point being that those that make the legislation and those that execute and do the organisation and promotion and financially benefit from the tournaments, that has to be separated. And then when that's separated, it massively reduces any potential conflict and interest. And unfortunately, the only way that one can do that, I think, is through legislation.
So national legislation going through in that would cover the UK or just England?
Well, the way it is at the moment, it'd be England and Wales for Parliament to decide. Although the Welsh Assembly might want to take a view as to what they do with the Welsh League. And the Scots, if they thought that they had to do it with the Scottish League, they would do it through Edinburgh.
So is the appointment of regulators a devolved responsibility, Paul?
Well, this is a very interesting point. I actually think that there's an awful lot to be said for this, and I'll come on to this a little bit later. Both the devolution and the regionalisation of football, when we talk about appropriate investors in football, I'll bring this point up, because I actually think there's a huge scope here to use devolution and to use the various political power bases that now exist across England regionally, but also across the UK in terms of, you know, separate countries. I think this is a big point, and actually, you know, people like Andy Burnham, people like Steve Rotherham shouldn't miss this opportunity to use their devolved powers to take stronger influences over regional football.
So fundamentally, what you're advocating is political meddling in the beautiful game.
No, what I'm saying is that the game has proven itself unable to regulate itself, and therefore it has to be regulated independently. How do you regulate it independently? Well, it has to be done through legislation.
Or they regulate themselves appropriately. I mean, we have to ask ourselves here is, are we, in doing what you call independent regulation, and I tend to support the view that there's no such thing as independent, because there's always vested interests. I mean, the first people you mention about taking advantage are politicians, you know? So the thought that politicians will find that they've got another football, no pun intended, that they can kick around is frankly scary as hell. But I don't think the appointment of regulation over industries is a devolved responsibility at the moment. I might be wrong. I don't think so. So perhaps the answer to Roger's question is it would apply to Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland as well. So that alone, unless, of course, when whatever has to go through Parliament goes through Parliament to confine it to England. So it all becomes something that's not going to happen overnight. Well, but if we're treating the symptom here, the symptom being that someone's been naughty and as yet no punishment has been applied, then let's really question whether it is a symptom that we're trying to treat, or we're trying to treat the cause. In other words, did these clubs do what they did because they felt if they got caught, they would not be punished? Yeah. So it is a complex game to play, this, I think. And we shouldn't naturally assume that because something is different, it's actually going to be better.
Well, can I just jump in on the other point?
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
The other side of independent regulation is that you have to change the structure of football as it exists. So independent regulation would set up a new body almost like a holding company that would look after the interests of all of football. So it would look after the interests of the whole pyramid. So you wouldn't have this separation of the Premier League, EFL, Football Association, you know, all of the leagues further down.
I mean, what you're proposing, Paul, sorry to interject, and Roger, we've had a chat offline on this, not today, but in the last week or so when Paul's blogs were coming out. But I'd just be pseudo-provocative. You're proposing, I think, as part of independent regulation, is to throw away everything that's been working reasonably well for the last 150 years or whatever it's been, and come in with some model thing that some academics in a room have decided is a better way to do it.
And what I'm saying is that the regulator, it's the regulator that sits on top, then there's a single organisation that is responsible for every aspect of football. So if you want to talk about devolution, the English game, the Welsh game, Scottish game, Northern Ireland, for example. Mm-hmm. If you want to talk about the different levels of football, you're talking about the Premier League as it is currently, and then you're talking about the rest of the Football League, and then you're talking about non-league professional, non-league semi-professional, non-league amateur, youth football, women's football, grassroots football.
All the things the FA do, yeah?
Yeah, but, well, effectively it means removing the FA.
That's what I mean. Something that's been there for 150 years or whatever the absolute number is. You're saying sweep it away.
because it hasn't performed adequately.
Yeah, make all those executives, you know, whether it's the chief exec, the chair, whoever it might be, the men in blazers, blah, 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 you know, turkeys voting for Christmas and all that. Sweep all those people away and find a whole raft of new people who are going to do a better job.
No, I'm saying put a structure in place. Some will stay because some will be able to adapt to a new model. Some won't because they won't want to adapt.
The model's not the issue, Paul. The model's not the issue. The people are the problem, not the model.
No, it's the people that's the problem. The model is the issue because football is hanging on to its existence by a very thin thread. If you look at the state of, for example, grassroots football in England, I don't know what it's like in Scotland because I don't go to Scotland. I imagine it's the same. It's absolutely appalling. You know, they play on terrible pitches. They have terrible changing facilities. They don't have good coaching. They spend most of the winter not playing because the pitches aren't fit to play on. If you look across Northern Europe, if you look at Scandinavia, if you look at Germany, if you look at Holland, if you look at Belgium, where they've got a proper grassroots structure, they all play on fantastic, well, not all play, but most play on fantastic pitches. They have trained coaches. They have a route map for talented footballers to go through the various levels to get to the academies of clubs.
We don't have that.
And
well, I'm sorry.
Down to the FA.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But you know what? I think we do. I think that, you know, there's always room for improvement. And I think it's somewhat disingenuous to those rafts of coaches and young people who are getting you over badges and are playing on 4G pitches and whatever, 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 whatever. I mean, there is little doubt that the Football Association could do more. But I will stand reasonably strong, I think, with the view that is the problem is the people. It's not necessarily the structure. And if we think the people are fine, you know, and it's the structure that's the problem, then why haven't they restructured? So all roads lead back to vested interests, noses in troughs, lack of testicular fortitude, people too scared to be decisive because they don't want to upset the so-called big boys and all this sort of stuff. And what you're advocating, I think, is a massive disruption to the status quo. You're proposing throw away the Football Association, you know, the people who invented the game, throw that away, maybe keep some of the people, even though they're part of the problem, and put in place something which is fundamentally dictated by government. And government's involvement in these sorts of things can't end well. And if I remember your blog correctly, while all that's going on, you don't particularly want fans to be at the top table.
No, that's not what I said at all.
No, that's my interpretation of what you've said. Yeah.
Well, that's a completely skewed interpretation, if you don't mind saying so, John.
Well, that's it. But that's the way communication works. The problem isn't with the receiver of a communication, it's with the transmitter. So if you don't believe it's appropriate, well, it's true, Paul. It is. It's always true.
The deaf can't listen, neither.
Well, fine. Yeah. But, you know, I don't think that someone who has a view that says fans shouldn't be on the boards of football clubs.
That's not what I said at all. Let me tell you what I said.
Well, Paul, bear with me a second, please. Yeah, I know what you said because I read it. Yeah, what I'm trying to express is caution needs to be expressed about how what you, not just you, but people in general, what you say and how it's interpreted. Yeah, because that's why what we always say at the end of this podcast is it's not what you do, it's the way that you do it. You know, that's what gets results. And I just think that there are people, you know, a whole, you know, some celebrities, you know, Saving the Beautiful Game. You look at those people, David Bernstein and Gary Neville's in there and Denise Lewis. And David Davis, indeed. Some of those are yesterday's men who think they can re-govern how football should be. And some of them have been involved in this game for years. Some of them I didn't even know were interested in football. And some of them have been picked because, you know, they look good on a prospectus. But back to the fans on governing boards or whatever it would be called when it comes out of, the, you know, what you're talking about, you know, changing the governance, the boards of football clubs, then the key stakeholder in this game is fans, and they shouldn't be the third thing in someone's plan of how it should be fixed. They should be the first thing. And what we're talking about at the moment doesn't involve fans yet. Right. And I think the FSF have a really strong role to play in all this. They are advocates of fans on boards. And so am I, but I'm not sure you are. So that's all I'm saying.
Listen, let me. Sorry, Roger. I need to.
Hang on. No, let me try and bring this to order. Hang on. That's absolute nonsense. You'll get your say in a moment because I think we're getting slightly off track. There is a need to change some of the governance and some of the rules in domestic football in England, in particular. Okay, the debate is now whether or not that involves an entirely new independent structure and we throw away the FA, or whether you just empower, let's call the FA, and you flush out some, you put in some new blood into that organisation. Before we deal with what powers that organisation, whether it's still the FA or whether it's called something new and with new people in it, just deal with this point about fans, can you, Paul? You've written some stuff about fans on boards. Couple of clubs seem to think that having a fan on the board is a good idea and solves all the problems. What's your take on it compared to what John's just said?
Well, I think John's, first of all, I have to say, I think John's completely misrepresented what I said.
No, I've interpreted it the way I chose to, and
well,
the conversation.
Whichever way you want. No, John, I've just listened to you for five minutes. Misrepresent what I've said, and it's in black and white. And anybody can go to the page on my website and read it.
They can't read the private conversations we had as well when we talk about governance.
What,
you know?
John, what I've said... John, you answer my observation anyway.
Yeah.
Can you just be quiet for a second and let me speak? What I said was the following. First of all, if the idea is just to allow some elected representative of the fans to sit on the board as a non-executive director, then that is insufficient. And it's insufficient for two reasons. First of all, for example, the Chelsea model, they didn't include any voting powers. And frankly, on a board of however many it might be, four, five, six, one vote is seldom going to be that important. But the most important point was as a non-executive director in this instance, you're bound by confidentiality. And therefore, what can you actually do with the information that is provided to you as a fan director? So that's the first instance. I did not say at all that I thought they shouldn't be on the board. I said that alone is insufficient. I then went on to say what I wanted to see was a fan trust or a supporters trust set up that first of all was had a board of its own, and that board would be of elected representatives from various fan groups. Could be the shareholders association, could be the fans forum, could be a whole raft of different areas, you know, disabled supporters, heritage society, etc., etc. We know who all those organizations are. That fan trust, supporters trust, would hold some voting shares in the club. So there would have to be a capital restructuring of all clubs, and all owners would have, under my regulatory umbrella, would have to cede a voting control or an element of voting control to the supporters trust. I'll get onto that in a minute. The supporters trust would provide, would have a board of its own, and that might be, you know, sort of 6-8 people. It would also have the opportunity to bring in independent non-executive trustees to that board, so that they could bring in external expertise. And importantly, they could bring in expertise that's not necessarily looked at through the lens of a football supporter of a particular club. So you get a degree of independence and you get a degree of oversight there. That trust would then hold either one or two positions on a board, the details of which we need to discuss, and they would sit on the board of the football club, and they would report back to the trust as representatives of that trust. They would have limited powers of veto in the same way that the football association currently has with its golden share. If you look at the articles of association of the Premier League,
how it works.
It's quite clear as to what areas the FA can use its golden share. I would propose a similar structure that would allow the supporters trust to have a power of veto over certain things. What would those things be? Change of ownership, change of control, moving of stadiums, changing of branding, changing of location, possibly compliance with financial regulations, etc., etc. There would be probably a dozen areas where the supporters trust would have a power of veto over the major shareholder. So I'm actually presenting something that gives the fans far more power, and those people that are executing that power have far more accountability back to the fans than what the FSF or anybody else is currently proposing in terms of having a single non-executive fan sitting on the board of a football club under the current governance structure.
So I'm
miles ahead of where.
Okay, listen, it's not a foot race
In terms of what are we trying to do here? What are we trying to achieve in terms of fans' involvement in the game? I am putting something out there that is significantly greater than anything else in terms of the amount of power and influence that fans have.
Indeed, but it's pretty vanilla approach to governance. And when we talked, and we did some of this on Twitter, we did a quite a bit more on WhatsApp, and obviously you've got the blog out there. But so we don't lose sight of what you're proposing, you're proposing that you would have a trust which would have elected members on it, which would therefore turn into somebody going onto the board and having appropriate voting rights against certain subjects. And I don't think you'll get any dissent from that because, as I say, pretty vanilla stuff, and people can see line of sight that works. But you also propose that trust would be set up with model articles defined by a regulator who was appointed by the government. And therefore, that's where I start to get a bit nervous around this. Well,
that brings standardisation to the industry, so that every fan trust or supporter trust has exactly the same responsibilities and has exactly the same powers.
Well, that might be nice. That might,
football clubs.
Well, yeah, but that might be nice and tidy. But that, it's a bit like your advocacy for sweeping away the FA. It also sweeps away any trust that's already in existence, any trust that has been operating to the supporters' direct model for God knows how many years, and says, we're actually going to start with a brand spanking clean piece of paper. And if you disenfranchise all those people who've put their hearts and minds behind this for many years, working to an outcome, which is emotively, maybe by me, not you, whatever, referenced as, having fans on the board, yeah, then that's just, it's like an academic exercise rather than what it needs to be, is to not just get fans on the board, but the right fans on the board. And I agree with you that that model approach to governance, which theoretically brings appropriate levels of influence. But everything you just described, if we just applied it to Everton Football Club and nothing else, they could do it tomorrow if they wanted to. And that's what gets, and they won't, will they? Because they'll get into the issues of whether that gives them competitive disadvantage rather than it could give them competitive advantage if they did it in the right way. And that's why if you read, and I'm sure you have, you know, The Beautiful Game or Saving the Beautiful Game thing, the thing that Gary Neville's a party to, their views might not be dissimilar. But the reality is having anybody sitting in a boardroom who is perceived to be a fan, a rank and file fan, is a step in the right direction. And I think where you and I diverge is you want the perfect outcome rather than perhaps where the FSF are going, which is once we have someone on the board, at least then they're engaging, then we can move on to the next stage, rather than a boil the ocean or a complete reset. And I just don't know whether the boiling the ocean approach will ever happen unless it is imposed by government. And that's when you get back round the loop again for me, that political meddling in the beautiful game may not end well in the long run. And so we are where we are.
Can I just jump in with a very simple question here? Whether we have fans in the boardroom or not, with 2 points. One, we're debating whether or not football clubs are clubs or businesses. That's what we're actually talking about here. Clubs where there are members and members who have certain rights. Now, Real Madrid and Barcelona pretend they have with their socios system, but they don't. You know, they're ultimately at the behest of the owner and the rich benefactor. So do we want these football clubs with their hundreds of years of good old British heritage, do we want them to remain clubs, or do we acknowledge finally that they are businesses? And then the second point about having fans on the board is, what do fans want? Fans just want their team to win. Fans want their team to play well. Fans want to be entertained, be able to get a ticket for the game at a reasonable price and, you know, get some merchandise from the shop. And then they want to have a good old moan. Do fans really want to be on the board? I don't think they do, to be honest with you. I've got no interest. Personally, if Denise phoned me up and said, Roger, I want you to come on the board of Everton Football Club, I've got absolutely no interest in doing that at all. And I just want my team to, my club to play well and win, and actually win ahead of playing well. So are we not kind of just, you know, trying to solve a problem that's not even there, Paul?
I think you'd have to ask the supporters of Leeds United, Portsmouth, Charlton Athletic, Wigan, Bury, you know, plus many others.
But I'll counter that immediately by asking the fans of Chelsea, asking the fans of Manchester City, asking the fans of Liverpool. You know, I just don't buy these Man United fans protesting. I don't buy it, because they want success. And if that success comes through having an owner with a bag full of cash who maybe has dubious morals, do they really care?
The United fans were not protesting about the Super League. This is a complete misrepresentation by the media. The United fans were protesting against the Glazers. It was a club-specific...
They took an opportunity, yeah.
It was a club-specific complaint and campaign and action. Yet it was completely misrepresented as being part of the Super League. It had nothing to do with the Super League.
Okay, but if United were top of the table and United were in a Champions League final, would they still be protesting?
I think some United fans actually would, because they'll turn around and say, you know, more than £1 billion has gone out of the club in interest payments that wouldn't have had to have gone out if the capital structure was different. And that £1 billion would have made us even more competitive than we are today.
Yeah, I think the Super League, though, Paul, to be honest about, and Manchester United fans, and I've spoke to Pete Molyneux about this, was the catalyst for their long-standing...
It gave them the opportunity.
Yeah, but it was the catalyst for their long-standing dissatisfaction with the model you just described, where the owners are taking money out rather than where we've got one putting money in. And it was the straw that broke the camel's back, because not only were the Glaziers happy to feed off Manchester United's worldwide brand, they were also happy to feed off the destruction of the football pyramid as well. So I don't think it's quite right to say it had nothing to do with the Super League, but their objective, yes, absolutely, is quite clearly Glazers out, isn't it?
Yeah, it's club-centric, yeah.
Yeah, but I think this boiling the ocean approach to dealing with this imply, well, we'll throw the baby out with the bathwater, won't we? Because if you discharge and disband the Football Association and everything that's ever gone with it, and try and impose a vanilla structure, which therefore has been proven to be successful in other places, top down, driven by government, which is going to go right down to those Sunday league lads and lasses playing football tomorrow. I just don't think it's going to happen. And I think the vested interests again will come into play. And whatever we say about fans, I'm with Roger. The biggest vested interest they have is in their club winning football matches. And therefore, going forward, I think there's some parts of any person's view who's got a good brain like yourself on how governance should be addressed might not have to drift much further away than give an entity that golden share and define the things that you can't do unless the golden share, or however it's expressed, is placed on the side of yes. I mean, we talk about Chelsea, clearly, you know, Ken Bates was quite a forthright and a forward-reaching guy because the fans own the pitch, don't they? So you can do something quite subtle, I suppose, which, if wielded, could have prevented some of this. But I go back to this being the Super League, I mean, but I go back to what I said before. It's the people who are the problem. Before the structure needs to be fixed, the people need to be fixed. Because I think the FA and the Premier League and others, they have enough authority already to prevent these things from happening, certainly again. And I just wonder whether this massive reaction is more opportunist than anything else, because people have a view that the whole thing needs to be restructured.
And Paul, we've had a discussion about this idea of an independent regulator, whether it's a rebranded FA or whether it's a new organisation. I'm not really bothered because, you know, I think the FA's got, yeah, it's got history on its side, but all these men in blazers from
Taunton, yeah, I'm with you, yeah,
who, if it was a normal day, would all be swilling the champagne ahead of the cup final today. That's nonsense. And if the FA to me has not done a great deal for fans, because so many tickets for their big events go to their own representatives rather than actual fans of the clubs. But Paul, we've had a discussion about business of regulation, and we talked about how regulation isn't necessarily a panacea. You know, I'm thinking of finance, I'm thinking of pharmaceuticals, I'm thinking of maybe even oil and gas, where regulation, because the major participants in a sector have power over the independent regulator and influence, that things don't often work out in an ideal way. And how would you stop that happening with a new structure?
I think you have to compare what happens in regulated industries in various parts of the country with what happens in the same industries where they're not regulated, in order to see the power and the benefit of appropriate and proper regulation. I mentioned to you, for example, in financial services, if you can point to all of the things that you'd rather not see in financial services, organizations like Wonga and, you know, Provident Loans and this, that, and the other that still exist in a regulated industry. I get that totally. It's not in commercial industries a panacea. I get that totally. But then I would say to you, well, go and have a look around the world where financial services is not regulated quite as strongly as it is in the UK. China, as an example, where sort of backstreet lending practices make Wonga look as if, you know, they're a bunch of angels. So there is a clear difference, and there is a clear benefit to having appropriate regulation. We might not think that the utility regulators are particularly strong, but they do provide some protection for consumers. They do provide some conditions under which the operators of utilities have to perform. They wouldn't perform in that way if there wasn't that regulation. My point ultimately is that in the same way that UEFA currently regulates and licenses clubs to appear in European competitions, that is a form of regulation, except it's not independent. My point is that you, again, going back to what I said earlier, you separate the game, the industry, from the regulator, so it is independent, and then that independent regulator provides the licensing conditions for everybody that operates within the game. And I can't see a better governance model than that. I'm very happy for other people to come to me, or to come to other, go to other organizations, or through the whatever lobbying body they're going to use, back to the government, to come up with better ideas. Delighted if they do so. But currently, I see regulation as, first of all, creating a better and more equitable game in football for everybody. And secondly, something that's necessary, not just as an opportunist sort of power grab on the back of a failed Super League, necessary because of the total, necessary because of the totally inappropriate way that those people at the top of the game have managed the game for many, many years.
Okay. And moving on from that idea of regulation, which may or may not be a panacea, but certainly from what you're arguing would be an improvement, you've also said that this would attract a different sort of investor. And my counter to that would be that every investor just wants a return on their investment. So why would the Manchester City Council pension fund want any less out of Manchester United than the Glazers?
Okay, let me take that point specifically, and then I'll widen the conversation. This is where sort of devolution, I think, comes in. Clearly, the trustees of the Manchester Local Authority Pension Fund have a responsibility to their members, both the people who are currently receiving a pension and those that will receive a pension in the future. So they need an investment return. That's well established, and I'm not proposing that needs to be changed. What I'm saying is that there are massive pools of capital available to football clubs, or rather that would be available to football clubs if the governance structure was better, one of which might be, for example, local authority pension funds. And there is an argument under devolution that says, if all the investment conditions are met, why don't local authority pension funds invest in local businesses rather than, you know, maybe investing overseas, or, you know, the normal sort of portfolio approach to large investment. So I think better governance, better regulation attracts, first of all, a wider pool of capital. Why do billionaires currently invest in football? Well, they might want to invest for a return. Some of them clearly do, and we know who they are. And it tends to be a capital return rather than dividends, although Manchester United seem to manage, and the Glazers managed to take both. So that's one reason why billionaires, for example, might want to do it. The second reason might be political. It might be an element of soft power. So they're using football as a means of washing themselves, of making themselves seem to be more upstanding citizens of the world. And there are clear examples of that. And the third reason why sort of inappropriate investors might get involved in football, if you look at some of the sovereign wealth funds that have got involved in football for exactly the same reason, they've done so as a PR exercise, which might make them some money, but the amount of money that they've invested means that the amount that they will make is not really significant to the overall level of assets that they have. But the primary reason in that instance is it puts their countries in a better light than it would do otherwise. And what I'm saying is that you create a new regulatory and a new governance environment, and you say to the existing investors in football, you have a choice. You can continue to operate in the game if you so wish, because you've made that investment, but you do so under the new conditions. If, as it would be the case in any other business, you don't like the conditions under which you're operating, or you don't like the regulatory system under which you're operating, you're free to sell your investment, and we'll give you 2 or 3 years, whatever the appropriate time is, in order to do that. And because of the better regulation, because of the better governance, you would have other investors, institutional by nature, who would be prepared to buy those assets. And so my view, sort of, I mean, made a long speech, my view would be that you would have better quality, longer term investors in football, which would be to the benefit of the game, not a group of people or a group of organizations or a group of sovereign funds that have many different reasons and possibly different timeframes and different objectives as we currently have.
And in that 2-year period, you know, if it were the Glazers, then the Man United fans would then be protesting because the Glazers would stop investing. They wouldn't be able to, you know, whilst they were finding an appropriate buyer, the club might disappear out of Champions League qualification. They might lose out on the latest signing. And then all of a sudden, the Man United fans are protesting to get the Glazers back because they've got money.
We've drifted into this world where there can be no consequences of something that might improve things in the long term. Nothing that I'm proposing. I'm not saying for one second that there won't be disruption, that there won't be relative winners and relative losers. I accept that totally. But that has to be the case, because if you take the view that the game is fundamentally unbalanced, both in terms of its distribution of resources and particularly in terms of its distribution of power, which is the point and the view that I take currently, there has to be some pain somewhere in order to fix it. And if that means that United don't qualify for the Champions League for a couple of years, so be it. One could argue that Everton have been unable to qualify for the Champions League because of the actions of a United, of a City, of a Liverpool, of an Arsenal, of a Tottenham over the years. So, you know, that's in life, competitive balance swings from one way to another, depending upon the circumstances under which you find yourselves. And what I'm saying is that if there's a change in circumstances which leads to a better game long term, then yes, there's going to be some losers in the short term. That's just the nature of the beast. But the losers will be the people that have been winning because of the fundamental unfairness of the game over many, many years.
The losers will be the fans, Paul.
Well, you know, the fans of the Big Six have had a...
Don't call them the Big Six. They're the treacherous six.
It's the first time I've used the expression Big Six in a while, sorry. the fans of the Six, one could argue, have had a disproportionately good time over the last 20 years. So, and as a result of that, everybody else has had a disproportionately bad time. That is the nature of competition, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the point about what I'm saying about the changes. If the changes mean that some people are going to lose out for a period of time, then so be it, because actually the journey and where you end up, the destination, is better than what we have currently.
I think, sadly, we're coming to the end of this, or quite close to the end, just judging by the time, Paul. And so maybe we should actually, Roger, do this again. But I just, you know, want to make an observation on the things that you were saying, and I think what we should explore next time is you very much were talking about a structural adjustment. You were very much talking about actually, and maybe it is right if you have a politically appointed regulator, because much of what you were talking about then had politics wrapped around it, because, I mean, small p politics. Because you were referring to investors as being inappropriate, you know, and you've then clearly expressed a personal view of the type of investors you thought were inappropriate and the type of investors you think are appropriate. And it obviously offers the question, which is why I think we need to do it again sometime, Roger, is who decides who's appropriate and who's inappropriate, and how much, frankly, not regulation, but control over how the game is shaped, are people who are more interested potentially in how it's structured and how it's almost like price control type stuff. You know, we all know when governments start getting involved in some things that they don't actually make it better, they make it worse. And you painted a lovely sunny day plan that says there may be, you know, rocky times ahead, but the promised land is on the other side of it. And the thought to the regulation fan that is encapsulated in, and if Man United don't qualify for the Champions League, so be it. We have to bring fans, not we as a threesome, but fans need to be confident, not even comfortable, confident that if they're going to, if the structure, the governance approach, whatever, is going to be different, it has to be demonstrably better. And the most acute vested interest in this game of ours is the fans themselves. And the thought that for the promised land, which may be 5+ years away, between now and then, one of the giants of this game, because they happen to be owned by the wrong kind of investor, could actually have fallow years, because that's a product of interference from a independent regulator, then that is a conversation we should explore in some depth next time.
Very happy to explore that.
And I think it'd be really good, Paul, and I think we'll come out the other end with probably closer to agreeing with each other than we perhaps have today. But yeah,
we don't want you agreeing. It's much better when you disagree. Who's got one more thing for me?
Come on, there is only one person who's allowed to have the one more thing. Yeah, go for it, Paul.
All of what I've said is sort of predicated on the belief that football, if it's left to its own devices, will destroy itself. The largest clubs, the clubs with the most resources, have tried twice now in the last 6 months to reorganize competitions in a way which would have drawn the drawbridge up completely for anybody else. Everybody else would have been left feeding off the crumbs from their overladen table. So my fundamental belief is that football, if left alone, will destroy itself, and therefore we have to come in and fix the patient, even if the medicine sometimes is a little unpleasant for one or two people, in order to ensure not only that the patient survives, but that the patient thrives.
Excellent. John, you've had quite a lot to say today, even more than normal. I suggest you might have one more thing too.
I do, and it's to because I fundamentally agree with what Paul just said. I think you said it perhaps an hour ago, Paul, and I think we shouldn't lose sight here, Roger, that right now, going back to the treacherous six again, the Premier League has an opportunity, and its stakeholders, to do the right thing, yeah? And if they don't do the right thing, Paul's prediction just then stops being an opinion and just becomes a future fact, that it could be very well be the tipping point that says, if you do not address this issue and punish these people in the right way, you are demonstrating to all and sundry you're not fit to self-govern.
Okay. Look, that's been quite, even by our standards, quite a passionate debate for an hour. Thank you both for your time. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, John. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Everton Business Matters, we try and explore topics and not dodge those that are difficult. And some of Paul's plans here really are quite revolutionary. So revolutionary that, you know, I've got John Blaine defending the Football Association, which really is quite an extraordinary thing. When I think he's also well aware of some of its shortcomings. There is no doubt that football faces a real crossroads, and there is an opportunity for change. Quite how brave those in government, those at the individual clubs, are prepared to be to bring about that change, and the media and those who cover this great game and make a good living out of it are prepared to be, and quite how revolutionary they're prepared to be, only time will tell. I think Paul makes a compelling case for independent regulation and a change to governance, which may or may not need to sweep away hundreds of years of history. And John makes a compelling case for fan involvement, as does Paul. The question is the degree to which those fans have already done that so far with the various organisations that they've set up. These are challenging times. These are potentially exciting times. And Everton still have a chance of Europe. So let's keep dreaming of that. And with a points deduction, we'd even have a better chance of getting into Europe. So as we always say on Everton Business Matters, it ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. Right now, with the government, with the FA, with the Premier League, with the UEFA, we ain't really got a clue what they're going to do. But we really hope they do it in the right way. Until the next time, up the toffees. Watch it, it's been a